This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the battle for the Senate in Maryland and a law that would require HPV vaccinations for young girls. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. is economist Julianne Malveau. Julianne is also president and CEO of Last Word Productions. Julianne, nice to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University and a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Nat, nice to have you.
Hey, good to see you. And hear you, Tony.
Nice to have you back. And from our New York bureau, Pedro Nogueira. I think I said that right, Pedro. Correct me if I didn't. A professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at NYU. Pedro, nice to have you, too. We have quite an eclectic mix of topics, so let's jump into the first one. Michigan girls entering the sixth grade next year would have to be vaccinated against cervical cancer under legislation backed Tuesday by a bipartisan group of female lawmakers. The legislation is the first of its kind in the United States, says lead sponsor Republican State Senator Beverly Hammerstrom. And the vaccine was approved by the FDA in June for use in girls and women and has been hailed as a breakthrough in cancer prevention. It prevents infections from some strains of the sexually transmitted human papilloma virus, which can cause cervical cancer and genital warts. So let me just say as a preamble to this that I asked in an informal poll around the office yesterday of people whether or not they would give this vaccine to their daughters. And overwhelmingly, they said no. So let me ask you, Julianne, what do you say?
I would absolutely. I know a young woman who was diagnosed with cervical cancer at age 25 and, you know, almost lost her life, is now infertile and, you know, would like to have a family and she can't. She's done a lot of activism and writing around the issue, which has raised my awareness about it. I think that people need to do a little study here. No one wants to send young women a signal that it's okay to have sex, but the fact is that the consequences of this particular cancer can be devastating. And if you can prevent it with a simple vaccine, I say why not? I think that, you know, a lot of times we get into this notion that sex education means people are going to have sex. It doesn't mean that. It means that you're giving people awareness. And in this case, you're really protecting them from a horrible disease. This is a bipartisan piece of legislation. I think, you know, women understand this very well. And I'm sorry that the folks in the office don't, but maybe you'll play this tape for them and ask them to please reconsider.
Well, I'll tell you what their answer, what their reasoning was. It was that they felt that there wasn't enough testing known and they didn't want to, their children to be used experimentally. And they wanted to wait a little while before subjecting them to something like this. Nat, what do you say?
Well, I mean, that's a reasonable objection, except that the scientific community has already declared that this vaccine has been proven to be safe as any other vaccines that we've had. I think that I'm with Julianne on this. I don't understand how you could possibly, and I will concede that some people may not know the science behind it, but it seems to me that this is clearly a matter of public health. It's not even a moral issue. It is a matter of public health. And for women who are, for those who may think that is a matter of just purely a moral health, a moral issue, that is to say, concern about the abstinence or the fact that we may be encouraging young women to have sex, I don't think that's it at all. The fact is, women are the ones who will get this disease. And you have to remember, even if a young woman is celibate, that she may marry someone who has not been. And so, therefore, she will be the one who would contract this disease. I think the greater issue that we're going to have to deal with is who's going to pay for this. This vaccine cost a lot of money, and the average cost of vaccines a few years ago was you could get all the childhood vaccines would be under $100. They're already $1,250 right now, and this one adds $300. So if we were talking about vaccinating all of the young women in this country, who's going to pay for it?
Well,
this is, by the way, a worldwide disease.
In the case of Michigan, where this legislation is being considered, it is said that the Michigan employers will cover the cost of the vaccine. And you're right. The three-shot vaccination is going to cost $360. Let me bring Pedro in. Do you think that there are some cultural issues associated with people's fears regarding giving a vaccination like this?
I do. And I think that while it may not be warranted, there's a great deal of suspicion out there in black communities, but also in other communities about any mass immunization campaign. that we did have a record of forced sterilizations in Puerto Rico not too long ago. So those kinds of fears are out there. And so if the science is good, if these immunizations have been field tested, I would hope the FDA has done a good job. Then what's going to be very important if they do pass this legislation in Michigan is that there be a massive education campaign explaining why this kind of immunization is necessary, that it is safe, and that that encouraging families to voluntarily go and come forward. Otherwise, I think you'll see a lot of people who will hesitate to subject their children to this.
It certainly is a topic that touches the nerves of a number of people. We'll keep our eyes on that one. Let's move on to topic number two. Representative Benjamin L. Cardin was declared the winner over colleague Kwaisi Mfume in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, and that set up a showdown with Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, as you all know, in one of the most closely watched general election races in the nation. With more than 93% of the precincts reporting, Cardin had edged out Mfume by 8 percentage points. So here's one of my questions to you, and I'll throw it to you first, Nat. What does this say about Mfume? Is this a harbinger of the end of his political career, or is that reading too much into it?
Well, I think that it might be reading a little too much into it, Tony. He didn't get the support, I don't think, from the National Democratic Committee, as at least, I'm here in North Carolina. Julianne knows this better than I do, but my sense of it is that he didn't get the support that Cardin got from the Democrats. And I think this is what's going to really help Steele win this this election. I think that for Mfume, he probably may run for the for the mayor of Baltimore and probably will be successful. But I think in terms of Michael Steele's opportunity now, he stands a really good chance of winning this campaign.
And I think that's because
I was going to say that the reason I think he stands a chance of winning was because I think that Steele, Mfume having lost, Steele has an opportunity to appeal to the independent streak within the black community. And I think it's emerging not as blacks are going to be suddenly Republican. I just think they're going to be less likely now to be Democratic. And I think that's where Steele has an opportunity. But you go ahead. You might disagree.
Yeah, what do you say, Julianne?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Kwesi did not have the support that he deserved to get from the Democratic establishment. Of course, the DNC has a basic policy of not endorsing in primaries. So Cardin was able to get the support of a couple, Steny Hoyer and a couple of other people. But what was interesting about this campaign, especially the most recent debate, as you saw it play out, is that there's a very cordial relationship between Cardin and Mfume. So this was not one of these acrimonious, talk about your mama kind of campaigns. Mm-hmm. This was very collegial campaign. And my thinking is that if Cardin is able to convince Mfume to campaign with him and for him, that they will, you may be able to neutralize the race factor. I do know that in Prince George's County, and especially among many African-American males, Steele is very popular. He plays it very interestingly. I mean, he goes to the black church, Bible thumping. But he's a smart, charismatic speaker who older sisters, he sort of caters to him. And so when you see him in action,
he's good.
You see a real politician there. But I do believe that edge could be blunted if Cardin can get Mfume to campaign with him. And, Mfume may have some debt. There may be a deal that needs to be cut. But I don't think it's a done deal that Michael Steele is in there at all. This is going to be a hot race and one to certainly watch.
Well, Pedro, were you surprised that Mfume didn't win?
I think it's very hard for a particularly a black-identified candidate like Mfume to win in a state with, like most states, the majority white electorate. I think that if you look at the states that have produced black statewide leadership, like Illinois with Obama or Wilder in Virginia, it tends to be that these are candidates that kind of downplay race and have a different kind of appeal. And Mfume clearly, coming out of the NAACP, the Black Caucus, out of Baltimore, he's very black-identified. And I think it still speaks to the ways in which the electorate is very divided on the basis of race, that it's hard for a black elected official or a black politician to be elected statewide in a majority white state because of the race factor. And I think that hurt Mfume.
I just want to say that we're going to have a lot more on this race and Political Corner coming up a little bit later in the show with Juan Williams. But I have another question about this for you, Julianne, and that is, as a black voter in the state of Maryland, when you have a black candidate like Steele, a white candidate like Cardin, who's a Democrat, does it create problems for black folks trying to decide whether to vote their political conscience or their racial conscience? Do you know what I mean?
It certainly does, especially when you have a candidate who comes off as attractively as Steele does. I know a good friend of mine, Dorothy Bailey, who was formerly on the Prince George's County, she was a county commissioner. She has gone, and she's a Democrat, she's gone with Steele, and I know several other Democrats who do plan to do so. I mean, they see him as pushing our racial interests. He is one of the few. He is pro-affirmative action. He's racially conscious. He's not playing any games with that. He had Russell Simmons down here a couple weeks ago to endorse him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he gets race. So because he gets race, I think that many African-Americans are going to have mixed feelings. On the other hand, again, I come back to a Cardin Mfume kind of deal. If Cardin can show that he gets race, too, I think that and Mfume helps him, I think people will go with him. Before, you know, the other thing I'd like to say about this race is, let's be clear, Mfume did not raise the money he needed to raise, and he had the base to do it. The one place where I would fault him, I mean, Cardin outraised him 5-1, so that he was not on television until the last 10 days of the campaign. Cardin, meanwhile, had been on TV for months. So, you know, he had a national base because of the NAACP from which really to raise money, and if I were to fault him on anything, it would have been that. If he had even half of Cardin's money, he would have won this race, Pedro, regardless of, you know, the whole notion of racialized black candidates not being able to win.
All right, let's move on to
You know, I wanted to add one other thing, Tony. I think Pedro's point. Okay, is that the thing about Steele is this, that I think he captures being a senator who is black as opposed to a black who is a senator. The racial identity is important to him, but I think he's capturing this notion of how to be a candidate who has particular perspectives that are independent, say, for example, of the National Republican Party, which appeals to the independent streak that I think is developing within the black community. And finally, the other thing is this. There's only one black senator in the United States Senate.
That's true.
Representing 40 million black people. And at some point, we've got to change these dynamics. I mean, we've got, you know, three states like North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota, have less than 3 million people. And they've got 8 senators.
All right. That was supposed to be brief, Nat, but I'm going to let you go on that because we got one more topic we want to try to get in before we run out of time. That's dealing with Harvard University, which is breaking a major trend in college admissions, planning to eliminate its early admissions program next year, ostensibly for the benefit of minority undergraduate applicants, saying that by not binding them to early admissions, it will give them more of an opportunity to get in. Pedro, what do you think of this?
Well, I think it is a good step. I think Harvard, it's easier for Harvard to do it than many other institutions, but hopefully others will follow. I do think that early admission does place students who are less informed, less supported in the advising process to get access to these elite universities. So I think it's a good thing. I think Harvard could do a lot more, though. I mean, last year, Harvard announced that they would start providing free tuition to students who come from families earning less than $40,000 a year. Well, I don't imagine they admit very many students who earn less than $40,000 a year, and I think they could go much better than that to really expand access to the university. But I think this is a good thing.
Now, you work in the academy. What do you say?
Oh, I agree with Pedro. I don't think that this particular program in and of itself means that there will be more minority students who suddenly can afford to go to the elite schools. I think what really makes a difference is, as Yale and Harvard have done, made it so that if families earn a certain below a certain number, $40,000 for Harvard and $45,000 for Yale, that they get free tuition. It's really about money. It's also about education. It's about parents knowing what to do. And anytime you can get the institutions, the academies as a whole, to make the climate in general better for minority students, it's got to be favorable. But this is not in and of itself. It's not going to suddenly we have 10% more black students going to the elite universities of this country.
You know, Julianne, earlier on the program, we talked about HBCUs, this being HBCU week, and talked about some of the difficulties they have competing financially and otherwise. Now, a program like this and others around the country that will make it ostensibly easier for minorities to get into those schools could impact HBCUs. Do you think in a significant way? Probably not, though, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I do think this is a good move on Harvard's part. I do think that early admissions has a tendency to negatively affect those students who don't have knowledge of an academic culture. It increased still. So many of our young people are first generation college. If you talk about Black and Brown students in particular, they're still first generation college. And they don't, you know, I just helped a young person fill out that FAFSA form, this financial aid form.
Mm-hmm.
That thing is complicated.
It sure is.
I mean, it's a trip. So, you know, when you're looking at it, I mean, our HBCUs will not be replaced. As Michael Lomax said, you know, half of the students who are going to graduate school are coming from HBCUs because HBCUs are equipping young Black people with a different kind of confidence, a different energy than those who have gone to predominantly white institutions. I have nothing against Harvard, being, you know, a graduate of MIT myself. That would be my only thing against Harvard. But you know, having nothing against Harvard, I do not think, as Nat said, that we're going to exponentially see the number of Black people increase at Harvard because of this minor change in admissions policy. There really does need to be, we need to look more globally, both with the HBCUs and with the PWIs, at what's being done in our nation. Our nation is divesting, not investing. Investing in education. We're spending, you know, less money relatively on education now than China, India, and Eastern Europe, all of which produce more engineers than the United States of America. We need more financial aid money out there for young people. We need more realistic kinds of formulas for the financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even more importantly, our HBCUs need to be better supported, not only by the federal government, but also by their alums.
Okay, we're going to have to run out of
here. HBCU alums have a low giving rate, and that's really a problem.
That was good. You had me worried, but we're going to make it out on time, which I appreciate.
We do our best, Tony, every time.
You do a good job, but boy, you make me nervous, I really tell you. Thanks again to Julianne Malvo in Washington. Julianne is an economist and president and CEO of Last Word Productions, Inc. From our New York studio, Pedro Noguera, who was an education professor at NYU and in Winston-Salem, Nat Irvin, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal and professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. Thanks, everybody.